Hey everyone, as you might have noticed, Debug now has sponsors, but we want to make sure that they are the absolute best sponsors for you. So we're working with the Midroll. They're the ones who are doing our sponsors for us. And we have a quick survey for you. It's an anonymous survey. It's a short survey. It'll take no more than 5 minutes, but your answers will help us match this show with advertisers who we hope that you will enjoy. So if you complete the survey, you'll be entered in an ongoing monthly raffle to win a $100 Amazon gift card. We promise not to share or sell your email address. We won't send you any email, in fact, unless you actually win the gift card. So to take part in the survey, please go to www.podsurvey.com/debug. That's www.podsurvey.com/debug. Take the survey, get a chance to win 100 Amazon bucks and to help us make a better show. Thank you. So Natalia did a talk at WWDC that was widely acclaimed about her first app, Fudu Kitchen. Am I saying that right?
Yep, that's precisely right. And well, it was also about designing for users in the autistic spectrum, all intertwined with making apps for kids and my own personal story and my way to becoming an iOS developer, which was kind of crazy too. Yeah. So that all just came out of the blue, just like the invitation for this podcast.
That's what we'd like
to
do.
Hopefully, Natalia, this podcast won't ruin your career because it seems very promising.
She actually just, not to betray any confidences, but she asked me if it was video because she said there was nothing but beer around. And I said that she's going to fit right in.
Totally.
Yep, there's beer, pizza, and pajamas.
So, yes. All the preparation you need for this show.
You seem almost overqualified.
Oh, and yeah, and by the way, there's also an old white MacBook lying around here. So I'm going to try and install Yosemite on that because you said that it runs well on Core 2 Duo.
It seems to. Well, yeah. I wouldn't say well, but it will run on a Core 2 Duo. It runs on my old iMac, so... I'm actually amazed they kept it, you know, compatible that far back.
They said they'd do whatever they could.
Yeah, I'm probably going to put Mavericks back on it because I've got to move this to this one to another location. So we'll see.
Undisclosed location in the north.
Well, yeah. Well, in the Sierras, it's a new house, so. So I gotta have a media server in the new home. So the old iMac is going to be it.
So the purpose of this, just so that we're all starting off roughly on the same page, is twofold. One is that last year, Guy and I did two sort of WWC follow-up podcasts. And this year we've done one and we wanted to kind of do another. And also Brent and Don were doing a fantastic talk at WWDC, just a conversation at the dinner table that I thought was a shame we hadn't recorded.
Yeah, you leaned over and said, where's my mic?
Natalia, have you looked at the new Mac accessibility stuff yet?
No, not yet. I haven't had the chance to do that. Yeah. I've only played around with the new SpriteKit features because we've been busy doing the sequel to our previous app because we want to work as fast as possible while our heads are still full of ideas. But I'll definitely look into that. So far, I've only, like I said, I've been playing around with SpriteKit a lot.
Cool.
So the thing that struck me about WWDC, and I've been thinking about it because I've been reading Renee's prolific writing on iMore about technology impact and understanding it for lay people, is sort of the intersection of, you know, what's important for developers and what's going to be important for consumers once iOS 8 and Yosemite hit. And it's really kind of interesting because if you look at the progression of the talk at WWDC, what Apple rolled out, you know, what's the one more thing at the end? It was really Swift. But I don't really think that's going to have very much consumer impact in the short term. I think things like extensions, Metal, believe it or not, that camera APIs on iOS, things like Test Flight And continuity and handoff are going to be the things that really change things for consumers. And these days, you know, being retired from Apple and being a retired developer, I sort of think like, you know, a consumer in a way. I'm really glad to not actually have to use betas, although I've violated that recently. And I'm curious from all of you, what you think the most important things for developers are released at WWDC.
I agree. I think extensions will be big. I think everybody's going to be talking about Swift, but ultimately, like you said, from a user's perspective, it'll be the extensions. It'll be handoff. These are the kind of things that, are going to actually make an impact in the immediate term. Even if Swift was much, much faster than Objective-C and everybody could adopt it and it was perfectly capable of running, of being used to create applications right now, which is debatable, still a little bit iffy, it wouldn't matter because ultimately you'd still be creating the same old apps. From a user's perspective, all of the extensions and that kind of stuff is new territory. Like we're going to see the Mac and iOS be able to do things that it previously never could do.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I think Swift will... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say the impact of Swift will be subtle. I mean, if apps crash less, if they cost a little less for developers to make, that means developers can create better apps and do it a little more quickly. But that's, you know, that's a really hard thing to notice, I think.
I think that Swift, the impact it's going to have on consumers indirectly are those two things, but it's going to bring in a whole new class of developers, I think.
Mm.
Sorry, Natalia.
I was going to say that I definitely agree with extensions being the most unexpected and the very welcome announcement here because I think that it's just the foundation for the future growth of the entire ecosystem of the apps. I mean, it just opened up this single application universe that had previously been sandboxed completely. And the impact of this is really quite unpredictable. It will take some time to disseminate, and it's going to be a huge organic change on the App Store. But I'm really excited to see in which directions developers and consumers are going to take extensions.
Yeah, for my part, it's just going to be perceptibly faster because, you know, for a long time, Apple's had to work with you carousel between apps, and it's very easy to get out of an app, but it's not very easy to get back into an app. And they do different things like embedded sheets and whatnot to make it seem like iOS is faster. But with this now, you know, previously you'd have to go to Pinterest, copy a URL, go to Pinterest, stick it in there, work on it. Now there's just a Pinterest button. Previously, you'd have to go between multiple camera apps and photo apps, save to the photo roll each time. Now there's just plugins inside photos.app. Previously, you'd have to, you know, go to an app to find information. Now you can just pull down Notification Center and a widget version of that information or small amounts of interactivity are just there. And all of that just works to take frustration and lag out of workflows. And I think that's going to be huge. And I think it'll take time before people realize it. But I think that'll just make all of our lives easier and faster.
Now that said, you know, since I retired from Apple, I haven't been an official developer or, been a recovering developer. I've had the free account, you know, but I actually went out and paid to be a developer now, but it wasn't for extensions, Metal, or anything else like that. I got to be honest with you, it was for Swift. That was the thing that really bowled me over at the announcement. And it makes little difference for consumers in the first thing, but it was the one more thing that I totally didn't see coming. I mean, I knew they were going to do extensions one of these days. There was some talk of something like DirectX before I left Apple. So you know, I could see how that would make sense. But man, I totally did not see Swift coming. And that was like, that made everything sparkling and new for me, because, you know, just years and years of using Objective Macro Assembler. Mm-hmm. Not that I don't like it, but, you know, even with the most recent change, what was the most recent change? Probably Arc, right? Back in 2011.
Yeah.
Which I thought was fantastic, which made it, you know, fun to use again. But it still didn't have the excitement of, like, you know, I don't know if you guys are Ruby programmers, but the first time I learned Ruby, I was, you know, delighted by using the language. It was fun.
Really? I thought it was like way too high level. I thought Ruby was like, computer, do something. And the computer did.
Well, but that's, you know, genius. I mean, yeah, that's what I want to do.
That's why I liked it. I thought it was pretty cool that way. It was very accessible and understandable for people. So when I saw Swift and, you know, the sale of, you know, its Objective-C without the C, I thought, what a great way to sell that, and what a great way to open up programming to all kinds of people. And that's, you know, that's, even though I was a jaded a self-taught programmer for years and years before I ever like stumbled across Ruby, and I was delighted by it. You know, I found that same thing with Swift. What was your guys' reaction? Did you have the same reaction that Syracuse had?
Oh, dear. Well, I'm probably going to come out of the closet here because, well, to be honest, we're right now at the keynote, and I'm sitting there in the second row. Craig Federighi's on fire. He says, okay, Objective-C has served us well for years, but how about Objective-C without the C? And my heart stopped at this moment. I was shocked. I thought, God, no way, a whole new language. Oh no, please don't do this. And there was a lady with a camera, right, like almost in front of me, filming live footage of the audience reactions. And I prayed that she didn't film mine, because everyone around me was like cheering. Everyone was super excited and super happy about this. But I just put my hands over my face and I was so shocked. Well, that was my first heartfelt reaction, because I was one of the very few crazy, crazy people, probably the only person I know that really liked Objective-C. And I just felt this pang of nostalgia when they announced that. Of course, now that I know better and I've played around with Swift, I belong to the excited group. But my first reaction...
Wow, that is so interesting. So you were the Luddite in the crowd.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That is great. That is great.
And I've never told this to anyone, so this is my big coming out. Yeah, but you know, thinking about this now, I think that it's not just Swift that'll make the huge change in you know, setting the bar, setting the entry level so much lower and making it easier to just dive into iOS development. I think it's Swift coupled with Playgrounds is what I find really powerful. Because when I saw Playgrounds coupled with Swift, you know, with all the values seen just in real time, I thought instantly that that's such a fantastic way to teach kids how to program and teach non-programmers how to do this. So Swift plus Playground, this is what I'm super excited about.
Yeah, I think it's going to change the approach and things like app camps and other engagement programs for children and newbies all over. But I think just as a you know, jaded old guy playgrounds are just fantastic. I really haven't created any projects in Swift right now because I just find it so much fun, you know, just to type in the playground or go into the terminal, into the REPL and do it that way. And, you know, they'll never hook this up to Objective-C. I mean, Swift is the only thing that's going to be in that playground.
It reminds me of Guy's comment. I forget what show it was, Guy, but you were talking about the difference between good and bad gamification and how, you know, dodgy sort of IAPs is the worst of it, but making things playful and delightful and discoverable is the best kind of gamification.
Yeah, I think gamification that got a bad rap at some point because it became all about basically in-app purchases and trying to screw people over. But, you know, games are fun and discoverable and playful. And I think that's a good thing to have in an app, and it's a great thing to have in, you know, these playgrounds. The fact that you can explore the language and the frameworks in a playground is brilliant, and we haven't seen that before. Certainly with the Cocoa stuff.
Yeah,
it's a little bit like small talk, a little bit, not really, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's just wonderful because you get this instant gratification for the things you write in Swift, right?
Right. Yeah,
that's exactly what it is, instant gratification. I like that.
Yeah, precisely. And you no longer have to compile and create an entire project, but you can like learn programming from scratch just with Swift and Playgrounds. So I'm just so thrilled to see this finally. And I wish it was there when I started learning programming myself.
When did you start? Did you start with C or?
Now that's quite a story too, because I started learning it for real for like about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
Or a year ago. I started off with Ruby, and like I said, I thought it was way too high level and I wanted to get down, you know, deep down to the bowels to.
So you really wanted Objective Macro Assembler. That's really.
Yeah. And I mean, I stumbled upon an iOS developer who was just scanning the room for disciples and he showed me Objective-C. Okay. And I loved it at first sight. And it was the first programming language that I learned. So it, you know, it was as if my native language. And I found it like fairly straightforward and natural. And it was just what I wanted. I just loved the way it was verbose. It read like a verse in a poem, you know. And I appreciate that developers coming from different backgrounds, such as, say, Java or Python, find Objective-C really exotic. They find it an alien language. But to me, it was completely natural, and I find everything else alien now. So this is where my nostalgia at the announcement came from, you know, because it was the very first thing I learned, and I felt very, very familiar with it.
That is great. That's just a delightful story. And so it's so fun to hear that from someone who has learned programming relatively recently compared to, you know, dinosaurs like me, because, you know,
describing it as a verse in a poem, that's,
yeah,
you get a medal just for that.
Yeah, just totally. I understand that. And the fact that you like the verbosity, that is just intriguing to hear.
Yeah. And, you know, with the long method names and verbosity and message sending, you almost had a subject verb object syntax, which is precisely like a syntax in any Western human language. So to me, it was very understandable as a non-programmer when I first saw it. And, you know,
it's like real writing, I guess.
Yeah, precisely. So you could like read it out loud and you could get some idea of what's going on. So that's what I really liked about it. I watched the Stanford University lectures on iTunes University when I first started learning. So Paul Hegarty, who hosted those lectures. Well, he's a legend. And like about three times in the subsequent years that he taught the course, he said, don't be too religious about programming languages. They come and go. But I developed an unhealthy attachment to Objective-C. Yeah.
But you're transferring that to Swift. I mean, the day after the announcement, I talked to some of my former employees and who have, like you, a tremendous love of Objective-C because they've developed so much expertise in it and they can think in the language. And they were like, oh, I'm not going to adopt Swift. Why would I do? And I thought, man, that's just nutty. A nutty attitude. But you dove right into Swift too. So tell us about that brain switch. What got you into it?
I was very apprehensive when I started reading on Swift and doing some tutorials. But after maybe like, I don't know, 15 or 30 minutes, I was instantly hooked. I just really loved that Swift seemed to be a modern and pleasant and very sane language. You know, by nature, it just seemed very geared towards the mainstream. It does not alienate from the start like Objective-C may do. Well, I only liked Objective-C because I was weird, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure that would be a trend with other starters in programming. But I just found Swift very tasteful, you know, and very solid. And I liked that it had this pop appeal. It just seemed like an easy pop song that would get a lot of radio airplay, you know?
Oh, wow. That's an interesting analogy. Yeah, I can see that. That's good. I like that. A pop song. And there's nothing wrong with a 3-minute pop song. So it's a really good way to put it.
Yeah, and I love the fact that functions are now these really privileged first-class citizens that you can have a lot of fun with, that you can treat functions as data, you can pass them, return them. That's really powerful. And as a game developer, I really love tuples. So you can really now return multiple values from a function, and you know, there are these lightweight bundles of just arbitrary amount of data, and it's just what I needed. It solves so many of my problems writing games. And you know, all this time there's this wink, there's this friendly wink at developers. For instance, at WWDC during the introduction to Swift session, one of the first things you see is emoji as variable names. So I really like the humor in there and the good nature and the good spirit of this. And I just love how powerful it is and how fast it is. Although I do have some reservations, but more on that in a bit. What do you guys think about Swift?
Yeah, Brent, why don't you, because you looked into it for a bit, right?
Yeah, and I was writing some Swift code earlier this morning. For me, looking at it on paper, I ought not to like it. It's got weird stuff like generics. You know, why do I want to deal with that? I'm not a C++ programmer. And in some ways, at least so far, it doesn't feel as supple as Objective-C. You know, there's no perform selector or NS class from string. It's more type safe. Objective-C is just kind of more relaxed and you can do stuff in it I don't think you can do in Swift, at least not yet. You know, and there's no message passing. You know, it's vtable lookups. So it's kind of weird and I shouldn't like it. And yet when I work in it, I'm like, oh, this is fun. I really like this. And, you know, I think there's no doubt in my mind that this will probably be the language that I use for the rest of my career. You know, I'm not 100% Swift right now, but I can see that in a year from now, I probably will be. Really enjoy it.
Now, you made a blog post about how, I think it was like a couple of weeks ago, how you were diving into Swift and you said, oh, crap, I have to get the Mac version of Festival out. I can't write it in Swift. I have to go back. But as I see your blog posts on inessential.com, which everyone should read, by the way, I see you keep diving into Swift here and there, not maybe doing it for Mac Vesper per se, but you're doing shit on the side with Swift just like gangbusters. Is that true?
Well, actually, I'm doing more in the Mac version of Vesper than I expected to.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, tell us about that.
Well, it's, you know, I'm just starting with very, you know, small things. Like, I'm pretty sure I can do this all in Swift and there won't be any, you know, anything weird that I have to deal with. And, you know, just try and work through those things. Because the main thing, I think there are two things. The first thing is I need to get familiar with it, right? I need to, you know, internalize it so that, you know, I'm not thinking about, for instance, optionals every time one comes up, right? I just know automatically what I want and I just do the right thing. So it's just like kind of practicing on the simplest stuff. And the second thing is, you know, if I can find some bugs along the way and help out the team, then I'm happy to do that. Absolutely. Because I want it to be awesome because I really do expect to be using the hell out of this in the years to come.
Oh, yeah. It's, as I explained to my Luddite friends who I've got 20 years on, like, what the hell are you talking about? It's like, this is how it works at Apple. You know, they bring out something new like that. They're not bringing it out tentatively, right?
Right.
And trying to pull one over on you. Natalia probably doesn't remember this because she wasn't programming then, but back in 1997 when Next first acquired Apple, and they tried to get people to buy into, you know, Next Step and Objective-C, and they introduced the modern syntax.
Horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. Well, it was, you know, it was to win over C++ programmers, right? Yeah. And that went, you know, that isn't even supported anymore, that stupid hack. So that's not what Swift is. Swift is like Apple all in. This is what we're going to do. This is the future, right? So why would you know, and you can see it that, like I said, there's never going to be a playgrounds for Objective-C. That's not going to happen.
Never.
Right? It's not going to be possible. So if you know that that's where they're going, why wouldn't you head that way? That's just stupid. Now, that said, if I was still at Apple and someone on my team, like my, you know, the mail.app team or the Safari team or, you know, whatever came to me and said, well, we want to rewrite the app in Swift. And I would say, well, you're fired. You know, how would you want to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of stuff is not going to happen yet. It's like, you know, frameworks aren't suddenly going to be rewritten in Swift.
Hang on, Don. Safari was one of the first apps that made the Intel switch. It was one of the first apps that made the iOS switch. Shouldn't it be one of the first apps on Swift?
No. Knowing the Safari and WebKit team and their love of C++, I doubt that WebKit will ever make that transition. Keep in mind, by the way, that with C++, LLVM and, you know, Clang and everything else is written in C++ too, so... it's not written in Objective-C, so it's very popular there. But the app itself, maybe you could make the argument that the app would go. But they're doing so much stuff right now that they're, you know, the app is moving so rapidly. I don't think that's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen at Apple. There'll be a new app that they need to create, either on the Mac side or the iOS side, and they're going to write that one in, I don't know which app that's going to be. They're going to write that in Swift. I was talking to some people online about Twitter and they theorized that the new Photos app for Mac would be written in Swift. And I was like, yeah, no, because it's probably, you know, 3/4 of the way done.
Yeah.
And Swift as a language, you know, it's not done yet. I mean, I was reading their release notes to the version that came out on Tuesday, Beta 3, Xcode 6 Beta 3. And I was delighted by some of the stuff in the release notes, stuff that they fixed, like, you know, redesigning. And I tweeted about this yesterday, redesigning the array class rather the array struct, because it's not class. We're redesigning arrays so they're actually work much more like strings and dictionaries.
So that they're not crazy, basically.
Yeah, they're not. Well, the mutability rules and immutability rules are not just batshit insane. Right. I mean, and it's funny, the documentation for that whole section went down to a paragraph. It was like it's like 4 or 5 pages long, and it went down to a paragraph.
Right. Works like you expected to.
Right. Next. And, you know, and by doing that, the DevTools team basically reduced the revenues of Swift language teachers tremendously for the future, because there would be entire, you know, week-long seminars trying to explain how the fuck to use array if they hadn't have made that change. So that was nice to see. So it's getting there, but it's, you know, it's not done yet. I mean, not that I use it a lot, but there's still no access control in classes. That's still on the to-do list.
Take a quick break so I can tell you about one of our sponsors, and that is lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, explore new hobbies, learn new things. They do it all with their easy to follow video tutorials. So whether you want to learn a new programming language like C, you want to create a graceful user experience for your website, you want to build your own iOS app, Lynda.com offers thousands of video courses on a variety of topics. They have over 2,400 courses taught by industry experts. They're adding more all the time. They work directly with software companies to provide timely training, often the same day new versions are released or new versions hit the market. Courses are all experience levels, whether you're a beginner, whether you're advanced, and there's one low monthly price. $25 gives you unlimited access to the entire library at lynda.com. So I've said this before, but I am trying desperately to get off GarageBand and onto Logic Pro from my podcast. Dave Wiskus keeps telling me, Jason Snell keeps telling me. I looked at it. I was afraid. I ran away, but I am now going through lynda.com, trying to pick up what I need to pick up. And it is actually very helpful. I don't mean to sound surprised by that, but you never know. You never know going in. And I was reassured by the fact that it was very good at what it does. So for any software you might rely on, whether it's Adobe Creative Cloud, Final Cut Pro, Logic, like I mentioned before, just go to lynda.com. They've even released a new iPhone app, a new iPad app for iOS 7, more visual, intuitive interface. It offers offline courses with video viewing, makes it easy for you to learn and practice anywhere. And you can move seamlessly between the mobile and the desktop. So here's what I want you to do. We've worked out a special deal with lynda.com to provide you with a special access to the entire library free for 7 days. Just visit lynda.com/debug and you start your 7-day free trial. That's lynda.com/debug. I want to thank you guys for supporting us, and I want to thank Lynda for supporting us. Thank you.
I think Chris Lattner wrote on Apple Developers Forums that access control is coming in a later beta.
Yeah, they actually said it in the release notes explicitly.
Oh yeah,
this time. But the, you know, there are also other weirdities of the language that I've noticed. You know, when I was reading the documentation, I was delighted by some things in it, but there are also other weirdities. You know, I have my own little nits I harp on. Like, I still can't figure out why there are no stored type properties for classes. You know, you can only do computed properties for classes, but you can do stored type properties for structs. What the hell? You know, is that a bug? Something they just didn't get to, or is that by design? You know what I mean? That's basically class variables.
Yeah, right. It would be great to have.
Yeah, you can fake them with computed properties because you can just simply create a function on the class that, you know, says return X, right? So it's effectively the same thing, but it's not, you know, it's a function that has to be called. It's not actually a location in memory. So what the hell, you know? I mean, I don't know why. And I go through the documentation, or I play around with some things, and I go, why is that like that? That just seems a little odd, because when I was first reading and playing with it, I was delighted by the delight, you know, the fun of this wonderful, easy, simple new language. I mean, it's got this sparse and sensible syntax. It's very symmetrical all through the language. And it has this weird, and I think, Natalia, you struck on this feeling of familiarity. right?
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, it just seems like you should already know it. And then you have features like all the safety in the language, you know, optionals. Holy Christ, I would have killed for this in languages years ago. Optionals and optional chaining. I mean,
optional chaining.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. That just rocks ass. I mean, that just simplifies yeah. code like you wouldn't believe.
Can you just expand on that? Explain it. What is optional chaining?
Well, optional chaining is the idea that you can basically do a whole specification down to a set of members, you know, in directions. You can think of it a stack, and you can have some of those things that are basically optional. And you're not going to run off the end of something and reference null. Mm-hmm. You know, the language is going to stop you and say, oh, well, that was optional. I'll just return an empty value here, and the empty value won't crash you, right?
Right.
If you can imagine, I have written so much damn code in my career in various languages that, you know, that it's like an entire page of checks for null and all kinds of things and how I can proceed down a chain. Mm-hmm. And it is not like a poem. It is not like a verse. It's like a ball of snot, right? Yeah. And Swift turns that into a whole like single line. And Natalia, you were talking about it, you know, reading like poetry. It can go back to reading like poetry then. And I just love that. And the syntax is so simple. You know, you just insert the question marks and it's like, oh yeah, well that would be optional, right? So
that's one of the things I picked up.
Fucking love that.
Right. During the keynote, I think they flashed up I think the first line of Swift that they showed had the question marks in it. And I got it immediately. It looks a little weird because you don't put question marks in code very often, but you immediately got like, oh, like the question mark means like, is the previous thing nil or not? And if not, right, then continue. Yeah.
Well, you know, if you write Ruby, you put question marks in code, but for an entirely different reason. That's right. That's not the way they're used.
Yeah. So there's a lot of this symbolic syntax that you happen to recognize because it's, you know, implicitly metaphorical, like the question mark for the optional. But I do have some reservations when it comes to this sugar syntax and this shorthand, because I think that in some code, this can get way too concise. And the fact that you can now be less explicit and rely on inference and implicitness, I think this can really lead to some readability issues. I mean, I'm not sure yet, but it's just like the only drawback to the syntax that I can think of. And take operator overloading, for example. I mean, if you look through someone else's code that overloads operators in a wacky way, you just think, what the hell? So again, I think there could be some readability problems, but really this is the only reservation that I have towards Swift at this point.
Yeah, I gotta agree with you that that way that is the risk. And they speaking of the syntactic sugar in beta 3, they changed that for a couple of things in very interesting ways. When they, you know, redesigned arrays to be more like dictionary and strings, they mm-hmm. they redesigned the shorthand syntax. And you know, as a longtime C programmer, obviously that threw me for a loop to type the new syntax. But you know, after in the playground for a while, I forgot about it, and I could use that fairly easily now. And it the new array shorthand syntax, you know, where you just put the brackets around the type that you're going to make the array, it seems a little wacky. But when you compare it to the new dictionary shorthand syntax for declaration and, you know, with key value, it makes a hell of a lot more sense. It's symmetrical. The one thing that bugged me, and I'm probably the only person that bugged, is the new half-closed range operator syntax, where they went from dot, dot to dot, dot. greater than sign, you know, which is to differentiate it from the triple dot syntax. And I was like, what the hell? So
yeah, I don't understand why they feel that they need two of those. Just do one. Just have one range operator.
Well,
get
sometimes,
it.
You know,
yeah, but sometimes, who cares?
It's very handy depending on the data type you have and what you're doing. Is I've wound up using them both in Ruby before. So, and before it worked just like Ruby. So,
but you can always use one or the other just by subtracting one from the end of the range.
Yeah, and I also hit fence post errors doing that. So.
I don't know.
Having the operator in there was, now I will admit this is a hell of a lot more explicit and noticeable than just a, you know, a difference of a period, but it bugged me because now I have to hit the shift key to type the goddamn thing. So I'm just lazy.
Well, the dot, dot, and the dot, dot, dot was bananas. That should,
For anyone playing Debug Bingo, you can hit the bananas button.
Yeah, that's, so, that should not have been a thing.
So
that's
spoken just, like a true C++ programmer. So do you share Natalia's concern about I'm going for the throat. Do you share Natalia's concern about operator overloading? Because when a lot of my C++ fan friends saw that Swift would do that, they were like, whoa, finally I can...
Yeah, exactly. Of course they were excited. I share a lot of her concerns. I like verbosity. I have no problem writing long method names. No.
Yay. Method names. Yeah, that's different than the scaffolding verbosity. That's the
Long luxurious method names are perfectly fine with me.
Completely agree.
Even if statements, I do like the optional chaining that makes a bit of sense. I have absolutely no problem with the language that takes me a little bit more time to type, because typing is not what I do. I mostly sit and stare at my screen until I figure out what I'm going to type.
This is true.
seriously. Like,
I know exactly what you mean.
Optimizing a language for like verbosity is the wrong thing to do as far as I'm concerned, because, you're not serving anybody anything, really.
There's a difference in that, though, because, you know, certainly in C and in Objective-C, there is verbosity of the kind that's repetition. It's like,
yes.
You know, when you had to do properties in the...
Before you had the property syntax.
And it was death, and you had a lot of replication, and you were writing functions for stuff in places that didn't make any sense when where you wanted to write it was right next to the declaration, right?
Right, very right.
So, Swift gets rid of all of that kind of verbosity.
Yeah.
But you and Natalia are correct. There's a slippery slope you can dive into where you're using $1, $2, and other horseshit shortcuts it has.
Exactly. Right? That kind of stuff, or the fact that it's func rather than function. There's like, when I say optimizing for verbosity is the wrong thing to do, I don't mean that removing redundancy is a bad idea, because of course,
that's exactly what I was talking about. Great idea. Of course,
do that. Of course, use the add property syntax. It's better than writing the setters and getters manually. But optimizing for having fewer letters in your words is like it's gone too far.
Tab after all to expand.
It's fu tab.
Fu tab.
That's exactly how it feels.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fu tab. That's a great way. Great way to express your frustration right there. Well, you know, they're getting away from that in the latest version that they did, because they've changed some standard library routines. The suck and pred methods are finally successor and predecessor.
Oh, that's good.
You know, they renamed things like that, and they're slowly going through it, but I don't think they're going to change ver and let and func. You know, those are here to stay, and we're probably going to get
Printlin.
Printlin. A print and Printlin, that kind of makes sense to me, because it's better than putts and print, which I can never figure out. You know, in other languages, it's like random what the fuck they mean. But I see LN on the end. Oh, it's going to add a line. So print is the shorter one. It does less. Print LN or print line is, you know, is better, right? I mean, that's, you know, makes sense to me. And it's like the half-closed range operator. If they're going to change it, even though I have to hit the shift key and an extra character now, at least the readability of it improves, right?
Sure.
So those things are good. But funk, I don't mind.
But so to the point about the operator overloading, I think you can do it well at times. Certainly in games, like you'd overload an operator in order to do math on vectors.
Yeah.
Like you want to multiply two vectors, you want to multiply a vector against a matrix, that kind of thing. And that largely makes sense. And then there's always some cowboy that comes and just does something totally crazy and you don't understand it. And you don't even get to see it while you're looking at the code. And that I really hate, because even if they wanted to do something fancy, you know, you could always just write a function that does something. I can't think of something. Multiply a string by a struct, whatever the hell that means. Let's just say somebody has an idea for it. At least if it's a function, you can go into it and be like, oh, look, this is kind of crazy, but I can see it happening. If it's just in line with an operator, things get confusing really quickly.
I mean,
ultimately, with anything, you need to be able to trust your team members to not do something crazy. But I don't know. It's like I think Swift is way better at this, but C++ gives people a lot of rope to hang themselves, and you find dead bodies left, right, and center.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of sharp edges.
There's a lot of fun to be had, definitely, but I think one has to be careful. Now, I have a personal question to you guys. Well, personal, about Objective-C and Swift. To me, you know, Objective-C still has this, you know, vaporwave kind of feeling where you just get different timelines and different stages in programming history all rolled into one. You get the dinosaur-ness of C. You get the times of Next. All through the way to objective-oriented programming with some relatively modern features thrown in. So Objective-C feels like this layered set of just different stages in time. Now, having said that, how long do you think it'll take for Objective-C to die out? How long do you think it'll take from Swift being an alternative to being a replacement?
10 years.
Just pull that one out of your ass, right?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean,
will it happen at all? I mean, do you think Objective-C will die completely?
I don't think it'll ever die, mostly because I will be cradling it in my arms, making sure that it lives.
But it'll be as popular as it was in 1996 again.
Yeah, I think it'll progress. Yeah.
Well put.
Well put.
No language ever dies, including some that really deserve death.
But it will be longer than you think. This will not happen by next year. I know internally they're not building anything with Swift.
It's not soup yet.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's not done yet. So you, as a project manager, you'd be crazy to start a project on Swift. Not only that, the build system doesn't do it.
So. Speaking of which, Guy, you're working on a Mac app. I mean, your Mac app is already out, but you're conceivably still working on it. Is Swift enticing you to do anything with Napkin yet?
I'll probably try, you know, like Bernd, I'll probably try a few little things with Swift. I just don't think that you can't get rid of Objective-C that quick. It's going to take a long, long time. All of the frameworks are written in it. All of the apps are written in it. There's so much code out there that's written in it. I know for a fact that Apple still cares if like the syntax highlighting is screwed up and or the indentation in Xcode is screwed up for Objective-C. It's not going away anytime soon. As excited as everybody is about Swift, we will have two parallel languages for a long time.
Well, and there's a lot of people at Apple, and I could probably name some of them, but I won't do that, who are in the camp of, you know, you're going to have to pry Objective-C from my cold, dead fingers, you know.
Yeah. Which kind of would be me, but I mean, that is an unhealthy attitude. Yeah,
yes, exactly. Like
but it is pretty cool that you, at least with you and Brent, you can you can add Swift to your program. You don't have to start a new project new and do a whole Swift version.
So I haven't tried that. I was actually planning on trying that early this week, but I got distracted by other idiocies. I was going to take one of the small programs I'd written in Objective-C and then just try to slowly rewrite it in Swift, you know, a file or a module at a time. And I've been diving into the what's the stupid the book called, the bridging thing, you know, how to play nice with Objective-C. How does that actually work? Because I haven't tried that myself yet. Natalia, have you tried that yet either?
No, I haven't tried the interop thing yet, but I've seen some developers during the Swift hackathon try it, and they seem to have succeeded. So,
Guy, Brent, what about?
So far, so good. I haven't really had much of a problem with that. Then again, I haven't done a ton of it yet either. But once I got the hang of, oh, I need my bridging header and have to import app-swift.h or whatever, things pretty much just seem to work. Ran across one strange little bug today where I was trying to coerce nsapp.delegate to a protocol, and that didn't seem to work out. Whereas nsapplication.sharedapplication.delegate would work. But otherwise, I haven't really run into much trouble.
That was in Swift code you were trying to coerce it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or Downcast, I suppose. Yeah,
whatever they...
Downcast just seems backward to me. I keep thinking their direction is up, but whatever.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's down because it reduces the... I don't know.
Yeah. But I picture,
I thought I had an explanation, but now I don't. So.
Yeah. I mean, I picture the base class at the bottom and more specificity is higher up, right?
Yep.
Like a pile. So it's upcasting. What the heck? I don't know.
Well, you know, that's the problem with a lot of this programming shit because you create these weird abstracts in your mind, analogs, you know, physical objects that, so you can move through.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really always make sense, especially when you talk to other people. That's stupid.
I have to confess to this day, I can't sort an array ascending or descending in the direction that I intend on the first try.
Oh, no, I screw up every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't help that the Cocoa stuff just confuses me.
Wow.
Like, what is it? It's ordered. Oh, yeah. Ordered same. NS ordered. What is it? Man, I can't believe him.
And it's ordered ascending, descending, and same.
Yes. Yes. I screw that up every single time. Whenever I write a comparison function, I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to guess.
Well, you know, starting out in life as essentially a machine language programmer, I just always have the layout of memory of the whole machine in my head.
Well, that's
and sometimes that's really handy, and sometimes that's just death to doing anything useful. You know, I always think in terms of how the actual bits of metal are. That's one of the reasons I started using high-level scripting languages, so I could beat myself to death, you know, and not think about programming that way as much anymore. So it was actually useful to me. I mean, Natalia, do these weird type of analogs or, you know, how do you imagine, you know, as a newer programmer, how do you manage your data in memory or anything else like that? Do you have like Do you find that describing that to some other programmer is easy, or is it weird?
I find it much easier to describe it to non-programmers than programmers, you know?
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's because other programmers have different, like, you know, ways of models in their head of how they're doing something.
Yeah, I always say that other programmers have bad habits. And their mindsets are always just, you know, stuck on whatever it is they're into and what it is that they had envisioned when they first started off. I was trying to explain the concept of pointers to my graphic designer the other day, and she, you know, she instantly got the hang of it. And you know, we used our tattoos as references to illustrate this idea.
Wait, how does that work?
It's a label, right? Of like where who you are or where it's at, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I also happen to have a little bit of a programming tattoo because when I read Programming in Objective-C by Stephen Cochin, I think there was a diagram in there that explained memory addresses and pointers, and there were arrows, memory addresses, and little boxes. Mm-hmm. So I have a box like that tattooed on my forearm.
That's dedication. That is dedication.
It is. So it's there to, you know, remind me to stick to learning how to program and stick to what I'm doing, because I did it when I was just starting out. Yeah, so we used that and she instantly got it. And I'm not sure it would have been as easy to explain that to another programmer that had never been in the C environment.
Interesting.
I usually explain it as, you know, there's a difference between a house and the address of a house.
Yeah, that's the one I used to.
Oh, nice one.
No tattoos, but that's also an analogy I've used for non-programmers. I've also said, think of the address as, you know, here's the actual object laying here, but here's the name of the object, right? It's a spoon, right? Mm-hmm. So the spoon is the thing that points to them. But you can only go so far with non-programmers before, one, you wind up confusing them, and two, more importantly, you wind up boring the shit out of them.
Well, it's not information they're going to use because
they're not programmers. So, yeah. But many times they stupidly stumble in and ask a question, and it's often useful in them learning never to ask you that kind of question again. So,
but no, I mean, I find explaining a programming concept to someone who has no idea the best way to learn myself, because sometimes you actually find out for yourself that you don't know quite as much about things that you think you do, you know, because the simplest of things just are elusive and they just evade a common way to explain them, and you just have to stop and think for a while. So
good point. So, go ahead, we talked about some of the things that's good about Swift, and we've talked a little bit about what's bad about Swift, you know, the possible precipices there. Just, you know, because you should never do this, I thought maybe we should talk a little bit about this. Have any of you tried any of the other big new languages out there? And we've talked about comparing Swift to Objective-C, but, you know, what about comparing it to, C++ or Rust or Go or Haskell or something like that? Have any of you given any thought to stuff like that?
I've only given a cursory look at most of the other stuff. For many years I used or had to use Objective-C. C++. I think it's better than C++, if only in that C++ is just crazy. Well, the templates, and I mean, you know, Swift has generics, but they're done in a pretty sane way compared to the C++ sort of template system. I don't know, just C++ just seems to encourage abuse. And if you're running a team and you're using C++, you spend a lot of time just telling people not to use certain features.
That's essentially really the what the web. Thing? Yeah, that's what the WebKit team does and the LLVM team does. They have a set of things like, because they're written in C++.
Yeah.
You do not ever do these things, basically. Yeah.
And both of those are good C++ code bases.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't looked that much at LLVM, but I've, you know, spelunked around a bit in WebKit. Pretty sane.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that's not because of the language. That's just because it's a good disciplined team.
I'm going to take a quick break so I can tell you about Harvest. Harvest is a beautiful business tool for tracking time spent on client projects. With Harvest, you can start a timer from anywhere using keyboard shortcuts, terminal, even other apps like Alfred. No matter where you find yourself deploying code, your focus stays on deploying that code, on the task at hand. Tracked hours appear in a visual time report designed to keep projects on time and within budget. You'll know which clients and projects are making you money and which ones are costing you money. When all is said and done, you create an invoice with billable hours in Harvest. So to check out Harvest, you go to getharvest.com and start tracking time painlessly. After a free 30-day trial period, just use the code DEBUG by August 1 and receive 50% off your first month. I've often complained, even on this show, that time management becomes something that takes time to manage. That is not what you want. You do not want to add a burden to things that you do not have to worry about while you're trying to worry about the things that you do, like coding, like getting apps shipped. Let Harvest do the heavy lifting for you. 30-day free trial, use code DEBUG before August 1st, and you receive 50% off your first month. Thank you to Harvest, and thank you to you guys for supporting us.
Now, here's the funny thing about that, is that I talked to one of my friends at Apple recently, and I was telling him how, you know, WWDC was great. It was a love letter to developers, and the thing that stunned me the most was actually Swift. And he was telling me that the team members, the core team, you know, that Lattner has created the last few years to actually work in the language, a lot of them are big brains from the C++ community from the early 90s. Remember when C++ was getting standardized?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of old-time C++ knuckleheads in there. And it's amazing they've come up with this language. There's also a lot of folks in there that are big fans of Haskell, which is probably, I think, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, safety, type safety is such a big paramount thing in the language, and, you know, optionals are such a big thing.
Yeah. And generic.
Type inference
generic.
Also.
Yeah. Type inference. But the thing that amazed me, and I don't know whether it's intentional or by dumb luck, but in some ways, how similar Swift is to C#, in, you know, what you can do and the way you can express things and stuff like that. And I thought, well, that's kind of funny. I mean, thank God, I think Swift is a little bit more sparse and certainly symmetrical, because C# is something that, you know, sort of evolved organically over the years. But that was kind of odd. And I wasn't familiar really with C# until some guy online, I think it was the week after Swift was announced, did some really nice analysis, comparative analysis of that. This was a C# guy, and he was like, well, it's, you know, Swift is certainly a lot more symmetrical and sensible, but it's quite similar. Now, I've been told that Swift was also drawing influences from Rust, but I don't know what those influences are.
Chris Lattner on his homepage says that he drew the ideas for Swift from Haskell, Ruby, Python, C#, and Rust, I think. So you're right there.
Yeah, well, I think the Ruby influences are really evident in the terseness and, you know, for example, a lot of the operators and things like that.
I think it's going to take a while to get. Objective-C and Cocoa have a culture to them, right? There's the I think if we sat down and we agreed what a method would do, we would probably all come up with the same selector for the message.
And very often the same name.
Exactly. Very, very, very close. Like almost identical with the same capitalization, everything. And I think it's because there's a culture surrounding it. And I think Swift is going to take a little bit of time to get a culture.
Or a religion, if you will.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Or really. Well, just knowing what idiomatic Swift is, well, we just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it sucks right now. It's like, for one thing, if you search on the web for Swift, well, that's a dumb idea right there because you find lots of fascinating pages about birds. But even if you try to do clever things like Swift plus Objective-C plus example, you still don't get shit right now because nobody knows what the right idiomatic ways to do Swift are. I mean, hell, the language is in the process of changing right now too, so kind of difficult.
Right.
Brent, so, you linked to a page and I just noticed, I can't believe I didn't see this post earlier about this Medium page called Swift Programming, which is just nothing but basically links.
Mm-hmm.
That actually looks kind of interesting. Are any of these articles really, have you read all these things? Are they useful?
Well, I've read almost all of them. The ones by David Owens II or whatever are particularly good and worth reading.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So it's, some good stuff pops up there. Also found a thing by Natalia's fiance, I think, on GitHub, a page about the things in Swift that are still expected to change.
Yay! That's great.
Oh, what's the... I gotta see that.
It's on inessential.com right now. I think it's probably
the top
link.
Yeah, you just posted it before you came on the show.
Yeah, yeah. just like a great resource.
Oh,
really
I just
cool.
saw that, yeah.
Oh, wow, that's so cool. We actually... my fiance got this idea at the hackathon for Swift that we went to last weekend. And during that hackathon, well, those were 2 days filled with coding and beer, delicious food, and socializing. It was awesome. We had people like Ash Furrow and Kyle Fuller and Boris Bugling from CocoaPods, and we had Matt Galloway on chat answering our questions. So my fiance came up with the idea to do a repo on GitHub, just doing a set of all the things that are about to change in Swift because the language is all still in flux. And you might end up learning something that will change in a later beta. So, you know, not to get any wrong habits. And this repo on GitHub has really caught on, I think. And it's got a lot of stars and forks. So that's one of the cool things that came out of the hackathon. I think that another cool thing that came out is that people stumbled into problems where they didn't know whether something was a feature of the language or a bug.
Yes. Well, it's like the one I was talking about with class variables. Like, is that a feature or bug?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. We just like all like 80 plus developers, we came to the conclusion that we should just all file radars. And, yes. We're super lucky to be at the dawn of a new language. And, you know, we can just influence the direction it's going. And we just decided to, you know, not sit idly and never just to rant in blog posts and whine in comments or whine on Stack Overflow, just file radars, requesting new features, asking questions. And, you know, this is probably the best pro tip I have to everyone with regards to Swift. Just, you know, be active and be open and talk to Apple.
Filing radars is an act of love, and we ought to love our language.
That's a good point. It's a very good point.
Well, yeah. I mean, Brent, you made a good argument earlier on that this is a tool that you're going to be using for years and years and years to come. So it's almost foolish not to do what Natalia suggests. And, you know, you should get in there and try to file as many radars and, you know, try to smooth off the rough edges as best you can.
Yeah, absolutely right. And when in doubt, you know, just file.
Give your fiancé an extra kiss, Natalia, because this page is just awesome, covered with awesome sauce. I mean, it's just really nice. Small now, but we need. So is he allowing people to fork and send a pull request if they come up with something else for the page?
Yeah, I'll give him an extra kiss. Thank you. I think it's public and anyone can make a contribution. If not, I'll bug him about this in about 15 minutes when he comes home. So no worries there. It's called Swift in Flux on GitHub, in case anyone's wondering.
And we'll put it in the show notes.
That's really cool. Really cool. Yeah, and you can use this as a basis of making sure there's a radar on all these things. And the radars do help. They don't have as radars from the outside. I'll be blunt. They don't have as much impact sometimes as radars that happen internally. You know, just because of the way the process works. But for something like a new language, they actually are paying more attention on the outside than you would think.
And Chris Lattner's been unusually vocal.
Well, it's the new Apple, and it's an Apple that I wish to Christ existed when I was working there.
Do you think it's a whole new Apple, or do you think it's just this group?
It's a whole new Apple. Okay. Seriously. I mean, it's not completely open. You know, they haven't gone all Mozilla on us, right? Because I was there when Mozilla went all Mozilla on us. But it's you know, it's a lot better. I was talking to a couple of friends of mine about how, how the glasnost, how the thawing is, you know, the openness is going. It's slow work, but it's getting there. And the nice thing is it's not, it's no longer, you know, when something is cordoned off or something is secret from another group, it's no longer, you know, virtually impossible to go and find out what you need to know. It's much quicker to get something like that fixed internally. It's much easier for people to actually say something on the outside without, you know, having to run everything through the head of PR. Well, partly because there's no head of PR.
Yeah. So, it's a little fallout from that.
And yet this is such great PR for the company. It's fantastic.
So it's going to be a learning process for them. So
until somebody says something stupid, but hasn't happened yet. And especially in this kind of stuff, I don't think you can go wrong, right? I mean, you're not going to put the company on wrong foot by talking about that. Like a language feature that may change. So
right. Well, this is the but I had that argument for years about things we were doing about WebKit, and it was like pulling teeth to get some of that change. And the fact that when we went real open source with WebKit, we were so-called open source in the beginning, but we were just basically throwing tar balls over a wall. Mm-hmm. We were real open source. That was just... my life sucked for months in that process, just dealing with various, you know, because you had to, just internal
issues.
Yeah. And it was really aggravating to people like Maciej Stachowiak and David Hyatt and other people who were actually trying to get real shit done. You know, Darren Adler.
I mean, you all come from an open source background too. Well,
yeah,
more or less, you know, so.
Yeah.
But what's that process like inside the company? I mean, how, if they're working to be more open, what in practical terms does that actually look like inside? I mean, you don't have people walking around saying, "Hey, everyone, talk more."
No. What you don't have is you don't have things like, like in the beginning of the, I think I talked about this at, did I talk about this at Innes North in my keynote? I was talking about, I think, in the beginning when we were doing the iPhone, access control was so tight that Steve Jobs had to personally approve everyone who would get disclosed on the iPhone, and he would only do a certain number every week. And then some weeks he just was not there. And it is amazing we got the damn thing done.
Neaton was on, and he described a story where a bunch of people weren't disclosed. So he had to go into a room, look at the designs, and then come out and draw them on a whiteboard, like clean room implementation of some kind of design for the iPhone, because the people that he needed to get working on it hadn't been okayed by Steve yet.
Yep. Yep. Mm. And far more idiotic things like that would happen.
I'm sure. Yeah.
So I hate to say this, but the fact that with Steve not there anymore, that's actually aided in the slow thawing in the company. He was very restrictive that way. And I'll be honest, you know, things like, we're talking about it earlier, you know, extensions probably would have taken a hell of a lot longer to happen if Steve was still there. I mean, obviously other wonderful things would happen, but it's a terrible thing we lost him. But that, you know, just doing stuff like that was not the way he prioritized things. So,
yeah, extensions
seem very odd.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a change of character.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is also what aggravates the shit out of me, you know, when people say things like, well, this would never happen when Steve was there. And, you know, like, it's a bad thing. It's like, you idiot. You know, there were great things about Steve being there, but there were also things that were just a ginormous pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Because
plus, anybody trying to second guess what somebody
was just like, it's just stupid.
Shut up.
Yeah. Exactly.
Very tacky.
Yes. So now that you mentioned this new face of Apple, the open and the approachable Apple, do you guys think that Swift can ever at all go in the direction of open source? Or is this a viable question even?
No, this is a great question. I had it on my list of things to discuss. Thank you for bringing that up because I forgot all about it.
I think it's inevitable.
I think it will happen. It will not happen in the timeline or quite in the way that the open source communists want it to happen.
You mean
and I can say that I can use that derogatory term being in the open source community for so many years. You know, they want everything, you know, completely open and right now, damn it. That's just not the way it works at Apple, even in the new world. But I think it will happen because that's Chris Lattner's background, same way it was my background, but you know, it's going to happen.
Well, he tweeted something about that. He said, let me get it finished first, basically.
Yeah. Which also enraged all the open source weenies. Like, how dare you finish it without us having our say and being able to fuck with the code?
Oh, please. You know, so
that's why I was using the derogatory term communist, right? So you have to take what you can get in the short term. The fact that they're being this open about it is just, if you've been at Apple, this is amazing. This is just absolutely amazing. Because we could have never done this with something like WebKit, I mean, in the beginning. Jesus.
Yeah, I think anybody that... I think if they had open sourced it, they announced it, and immediately there was like, hey, look, you can go check out the repository right here. It would have got forked like 80 times already.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And it would just be a total mess. And so I think he's totally right in terms of, you know, let me finish this. And I think anybody smart... that has been doing this for a while would realize the value of having a small team guide something to a point where it's then sensible to open source it and let people tinker.
Right. And you
just because you want to get in there and monkey.
The stewardship. Yeah, right.
Yeah, just because you want to get in there and monkey doesn't mean that that's a good idea. It's not like, you know, Linus wrote like a bare bones little kernel. Like he had something that would boot and do stuff before people started playing with it. I don't know. Objective-C was also open source, but nobody really cared.
Well, nobody cared because the runtime wasn't open source. It was impractical.
Oh,
the
that's true.
Open source. The runtime was not, right?
Yeah, the GNU had a runtime. Yeah.
Yeah, which is just not a good runtime either if you've ever used it.
No. It's pretty basic. But so wait, here's the thing. Swift uses the same runtime.
That's right.
So what is it? What are the implications of that for
bringing your own runtime?
Yeah, it's going to be the same. Yeah. It's going to be the same thing.
Yeah, because there's no way they're opening that runtime. That runtime is
so the question
rocket
is,
science
is
there.
Yeah, exactly. And so the question is can someone do something better than the GNU folks did with a runtime and make it popular on the outside? I don't know. But it's going to be the same thing all over again.
Now, I need to look into exactly what Swift does with the Objective-C runtime. I imagine all the classes are looked up and it uses all of that same mechanism. I know it doesn't use Objective-C message send unless it's sending to an Objective-C object.
Which is just, yes, and which is a great thing, which theoretically should improve performance because Objective-C message send is the boogeyman every C++ programmer and C programmer waves at Objective-C fans about performance.
So disagree with them.
It's optimized. It's much better than it was, but I'll put you in front of Maciej Stachowiak sometime and let him beat you into a pulp about
okay,
it.
Okay, but wait. Okay, yeah, but wait. Here's the thing. Objective-C message send is not a problem until it is a problem when you're doing something like what he's doing, which is dealing with a crap load of objects in this crazy tree. And then you can use C++ or C or some other language.
Right.
That's fine. You don't need any one language to be the best at everything. Do you know what I mean? For the majority of the time, Objective-C message send is not a problem. And when it is, there's plenty of other trapdoors that can get you out of the situation.
Right. But the problem is that a lot of people who buy into the religion and culture of Objective-C, they'll just write everything in Objective-C when it's not always appropriate.
Okay.
And the thing I like about Swift is that, you know, you're not... Your love for the language and using its paradigms don't screw you on performance.
Okay.
You understand what I mean? Right.
That's fair enough. But I mean, we're grown ups. how often does performance come down to how quickly you can send a message to something versus
Jesus.
Like, I'm just not even
going
to do any of this.
That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, right. It's like, it's better to just not do a whole bunch of work and, you know, like higher level optimizations really help.
See, Rene, when Maciej Stachowiak ever retires from Apple, which he should not do, you need to get him on and have this conversation with him. So
we're going to grab everybody. So Natalia, are you going to write your next app in Swift or what? Your next game?
We've only just started and, I'm still thinking whether it's going to be Objective-C or Swift, to be honest. I think it's a bit too early to go with Swift, but I'll definitely start doing this Swift full-time once it comes out this fall. Mm-hmm. For now, we're just having fun with the new sprite kit features and
those are
still
good.
Using good old Objective-C.
Those are great.
So tell us about those because I'm stupid. I'm unfamiliar with what the new features are.
Yeah. Have you guys ever played around with SpriteKit before at all?
Yes.
Yeah. I have not.
It's funny. My first gigs for writing iOS software were effectively making SpriteKit for clients
over and over again.
More than once. Yeah. So I'm out of a job now. But SpriteKit's pretty cool. SpriteKit is very cool. Yeah,
it's pretty cool. I've played around with the Cocos 2D before, but I jumped right into SpriteKit as soon as it was announced. Well, anyway, the new feature that I love the most is actually an Xcode feature. It's this visual scene editor, a level builder, if you will, where you can just drag and drop assets and edit their properties like position, scale, or physics right there in the editor window. So you just no longer have to adjust these manually in the code as floats. So, you know, to me, this is huge because we're doing our new app as a huge world to explore. And, you know, I think it would be an impossible endeavor without this visual editor.
So it's like playgrounds, but it's a real editor.
Yeah, precisely. So, you know, it's probably one of my favorite announcements at DubDub. You know, it's a godsend. It's saved me like 80% of time, honestly. There are other nifty features that are saving a lot of time. There's this new constraint class that removes a lot of boilerplate code. So again, Apple are going in the direction of getting things done fast and easily, just like with Swift. For example, you have a game where you have a barrel of a gun that should always point in a specific direction, you know, or limited to some angles. Or, for example, if you never want your game character to go beyond, say, the bottom half of the screen, you know, the classic way, you would have to write a really boring, long if clause to handle this. And now you just supply a very simple range to a single constraint object. And that's it, and you're done. So that really cleans up the code and makes it a lot shorter and simpler and cleaner. So I'm loving that. There's a lighting node where you have real-time lighting and shadow effects. So now in your game, you can have like real light sources and shadows being cast, which is a great way to add some juice to your project. And SpriteKit can generate this sort of bump map automatically for you now. So all those little pores and bumps are now lighted as if it was like fake 3D. So you can get really cool effects out of that. I've played around with this in the Xcode beta that I have, and there are still some issues, and it's really buggy for now. For instance, shadows are only rendered right now as the square bounding box of the sprite that the light is being cast on.
So it doesn't do the per pixel thing.
Precisely. So if you have a circular stone, for example, it just drops a box-shaped shadows instead of a per pixel shadowing. But that's probably going to be fixed anyway. But that's a really cool feature. And I love the new physics. One thing about them is that you now have an opportunity to be more precise and do things more easily. So before, when you applied a physics body to your object, so that physics such as collisions could be calculated, those physics bodies were limited by Box2D, which was underlying SpriteKit before. It still is, but you were limited by the limitations of Box2D. So you could either have a circle or a rectangle or a polygon limited by 12, I think, vertices, and you were unable to have any concave angles. So if you had a star or a gear, those are pretty complex objects and they have little nooks and crannies, which are concave angles. Then you had to revert to some simplifications. So you would have circles as their physics bodies to just simplify. And now they introduced a feature where you get automatic pixel perfect physics bodies. So you can have things like stars or gears or hammers, things with concave angles whatever they are, they're just, you know, physics bodies are automatically applied to them and they're pixel perfect. So now your collisions are super accurate. And, well, finally, there's physics fields. I just love this. So before in SpriteKit, gravity in your game was just a vector that had a single direction. And now you get physics fields. So you can have force fields and like radial fields or electric fields. So now instead of just objects falling in one direction, you can now things like a planet revolving another planet based on physics, which was not possible before. Yeah, so I'm really excited about the new SpriteKit. And I'm really hoping that it's going to be released earlier this fall rather than later, because we really want to finish our game soon.
Wow. So this sounds fantastic. Just a question for you, too. Being an iOS game developer, have you looked at Metal at all? And how does Metal fit into the world of like the new SpriteKit and things like that?
Oh, yeah. I'm still just beginning my adventure with this. So I've never done any OpenGL or things like that. I've only ever done Cocos2D and SpriteKit, but I think that Metal will be my next step. During WWDC, I met my German friend who had been probably one of the biggest specialists in OpenGL that I know. And he was so excited about Metal that he spent the entire WWDC sitting with Apple engineers at the labs talking about Metal. And I can tell that it's really huge because it just really explores the, you know, capabilities of A7 and just puts its power at your fingertips without the entire overhead of OpenGL. So that's, you know, my next target in my learning curve right there.
Kai, you did a piece for Macworld, I think it was last week, right, on Metal?
Yeah.
Yeah, great piece.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You may want to take a pit stop in SceneKit before you hit Metal.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't been that hooked on SceneKit. I thought it was, I don't know. It just didn't really appeal to me. I think I'll just dive right into Metal.
Okay. Fine. Well, it's just because SceneKit sort of lets you get a feel for what it is to do 3D graphics. Metal is what it sounds like. It's like low level. So,
yeah, and I just love that.
Okay, perfect.
So yeah, I knew what your answer to the Metal question was, because you, Natalia, you're not a person who's afraid of like really diving to the bottom of the pool there. I'll tell you, it's really obvious.
Yeah, precisely. So, that's one of the reasons I disliked Ruby and you know.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. That's
went in the direction of like C and Objective-C. So. So yeah, Metal's definitely next in the pipeline for me.
All this stuff announced at WWDC, because we talked about languages, we talked about all these new technologies, and then I look at, what was it, Renee? It was like 2 weeks after we had Google I/O and talking about the new Android.
Yep.
And then I was thinking, you know, then there's Android, and then there's Samsung, who's really the big manufacturer, devices out there, at least the ones that make some kind of money. How are they competing with Apple? It's like, you know, you talk about, you know, the hockey puck analogy, you know, skating. They're not even on the same set of ice here. I mean, it's just, I don't see.
All ties in, John. Don, it's going to be all ties in. No, yeah. They had their own developers conference last year. I'm assuming they're going to have one this year, but you know, that's, they're making their own hardware for someone else's software stack right now.
What's Tizen?
Tizen is Samsung's own operating system.
Oh.
It's replaced Bata, which was their previous own operating system.
Exactly. I think Brent's reaction is exactly what everyone else is like.
One of their three watches runs on Tizen now. I think that's one of the, and I think there's a phone that runs on Tizen.
Yeah.
I want to just jump back for 1 second though, because the thing on Metal that I found interesting is that you have a background in OpenGL, and I think that informed a lot of what you wrote about Metal.
So OpenGL has been around for a long time. It started out as on the SGI boxes, and it's evolved over the years, but it still has the same basic sort of flavor to it and approach to doing graphics. And as time has progressed, GPUs don't work really the way that they used to, at least certainly in embedded. So in the embedded space, the CPU and the GPU have access to the same giant chunk of memory, which makes a world of difference. Because with OpenGL, the idea is that you're always uploading stuff to the GPU over the bus, which makes sense if you're thinking of a typical desktop computer and you've got a graphics card, you have to upload a bunch of the textures and the model data and all of that. But when you have a shared memory, you can do a lot more interesting things. But the API, the OpenGL API, wouldn't necessarily allow for it, because it is meant to sort of abstract away the particulars of the hardware. And so with Metal and Mantle, which is AMD's one, and DirectX 12, there's been a movement in order to sort of more closely address what the GPUs actually do today. And Metal in particular is very tied to the notion that the CPU and the GPU share the same memory. And effectively what you do is you create command buffers, which tell the GPU to, this is exactly what you're going to do. And you can validate them ahead of time. You can validate the compile and validate shaders ahead of time, so that the driver is doing far less work than what OpenGL would do. So in a way, yes, it's true that it avoids the overhead of OpenGL. That's not to say that OpenGL is bad or that it has a lot of overhead. It's just that Metal is a more direct approach to programming the way that the hardware actually works today.
Well, yeah, that's the whole thing. Is OpenGL was a model that worked very well 20 years ago, but it doesn't really match where hardware is right now.
Right.
It can't take advantage of the hardware the way it is now.
Right.
And the thing that makes me sad, by the way, Peter Cohen wrote an article, I think it was yesterday, that made me sad by reminding me that, we're not going to get Metal on OS X. No, I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Yeah. Because of the shared memory thing. Like, so this Mac Pro that I got next to me, which is a very beautiful little tube. The way it's structured just can't use Metal, right? There's two GPUs in it. They've each got gigs of RAM on them. There's gigs of RAM in addressable by the CPU. And it's got a very fast bus, which allows you to copy stuff quickly up to the different GPU things.
You don't really need Metal on the damn thing.
No, well, that's the other thing, right? It's like it goes so fast, you don't really need it. But the architecture is ill-suited to Metal.
Yeah.
Metal works well on iOS devices. I doubt it'll ever come to the Mac. Well, I shouldn't say that, but
in that form, maybe
it'll yeah. It's ill-suited to the architecture of certainly the Mac Pro. Laptops, it could make sense with embedded GPUs. Like Intel has some.
Well, and that's where it would be advantageous, right?
Yeah, but
when laptops finally move to away from Intel, and they move to
to ARM or something, maybe
to ARM, which is gonna eventually happen, right?
I don't know. I mean,
why would that happen?
Well, and
because Intel is doing so poorly with getting Broadwell shipped.
Okay. Yeah, they're just constantly.
There's no way they don't have it running in the lab.
It's all about power. It's not. It's not about performance. It's about battery life.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, you'll see a bifurcation where a guy's Mac Pro stays on Xeon chips, but things like the MacBook Air or something move on to ARM or whatever is next chips.
And it's not like Apple hasn't done a processor transition before in OS X.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus. The other thing I heard, Guy, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that there, because Metal is an Apple-specific technology, there's some people who don't think it'll get widespread adoption because you can't write multi-platform. But on the other hand, you have things like Unity and Unreal that'll sort of bridge that gap for you.
This is so stupid to me. It's like Apple, it's only on iOS. It's not going to get widespread adoption. Jesus.
Well, people
Christ,
who are making cross-platform games, for example, the next big franchise.
Well, it's Objective-C. So no, it's not going anywhere anytime soon.
It gets the same tiny adoption rate that everything else.
Well, I think they mean like Call of Duty is probably not going to be written in Metal.
Oh, well, written in Metal, people don't understand the way stuff works. You have your engine, and 90% of that is sort of managing assets and managing the game world and loading and doing all this. And then there's the rendering portion of that. And the rendering portion changes between platforms. There's a PS4 version, there's a PS3 version, there's an Xbox One version, there's an Xbox whatever version. There's honestly, most times, there's a PC version, that doesn't necessarily
multiple OpenGL versions, right? There's for like OpenGL, one for OpenGL ES. There's one for this particular flavor of OpenGL on this platform.
Sure. Yeah. So, and especially if you're doing Call of Duty, the investment, to sort of write a Metal layer when you have a market the size of iOS is, you know, that it'll be done.
Okay, yeah, of course they're going to do that.
And I don't think in a lot of ways the Metal is a really nice way of doing what some console APIs have do anyway. Like back in the day, we used to program PS2 command buffers, and that was a serious pain in the ass. And Metal sort of takes that structure and just makes it really nice and easy to do. Only that, what happens is most games, you license an engine. You'll use Unity and you'll build on it, or you'll use the Unreal Engine and you'll build on it. And the engine vendor will have written the back end specifically in using Metal to target iOS. And you as an end developer won't have to worry about it. It'll just work.
Yeah, I think this is a win in three areas. It's for people who don't use these engines that are big houses. They're going to write one anyway because, you know, they write 10 of them right now. What's another one?
Yeah.
And for small-time developers who can't pay for licensing, they're on iOS where all the money is anyway. Yeah. They're going to use Metal. Yeah. And like Guy says, the people who are writing the engines that are shared cross-platform that are commonly licensed, they're going to do it, of course, because, you know, their customers are going to ask for it. So it's going to be everywhere.
Yeah. And Natalia, that's kind of why I was saying maybe check out SceneKit. Definitely, if you want to play with Metal, go for it, because I think it'll be a lot of fun. But the investment in bringing up a game on Metal is going to be huge, because you're really starting from the baseline there, you know?
Yeah, I realize that, but you know, the investment for me will be solely for knowledge and
perfect
learning purposes. So.
Well, that's exactly why you're doing this in the first place, right? That's why I was talking about the small developers are going to do it anyway, because they're crazy, and I mean that as a compliment, because it's totally crazy in the right kind of way. It's the hubris and ignorance thing, right?
Right.
That's why you do this for a living. How hard can it be?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the payoff is just your experience and your knowledge of the framework or the engine or the API that you're using. So it's a complete win-win.
That's awesome. That is the perfect answer, because I'm mostly like from a business perspective. I'm like, it's not going to be a 6-month project. But if you just want to go and have fun and learn, wow, you're going to have fun and learn.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
At least you get to Shipley.
Yeah, and the fun and learning thing, often you strike gold with this kind of stuff, and you encourage other people, especially small time developers, to do this. I was reading an article, I think it was day before yesterday, about how, the store is oversaturated now with, apps and stuff like this, and it's really hard to break into the business. And I don't know, it was just like a buzzkill for doing development. And I thought, that's just the stupidest thing ever, because with what Apple has brought out with WWDC, I mean, they're just people that are going to make a killing with extensions right now if you jump on that horse right now.
Yeah.
With Metal, with high performance games, with the new camera APIs, finally a lot of these other camera apps are not going to say, there's a 10,000 of them right now, but there's nothing saying with the new APIs there can't be another 100 or 1,000 come September, right?
Yeah, they really opened up the camera. Yeah,
I think it's just gonna, you think there's a lot of apps now. There's just gonna be an explosion here too, which pushes back. I think one of the biggest problems Apple has with apps is not a dearth of them. It's just that finding the app that you want is death, especially with the store interface. It's just not optimal.
I think that's more the issue that was coming up, is that you can do all kinds of great stuff. Just making a living selling on the App Store is not necessarily easy.
No.
For any number of reasons.
Just to get noticed.
And
I mean, it can happen even if you're literally out of nowhere, out of your basement. I'm a living example of this. And, we just did an app for the first time ever, just two girls without any marketing budget, without any publisher. We did everything ourselves, the entire thing. And, like I said, I think we were very successful. We got featured, we got, in the first place in the App Store in the category in many, many countries. And, throughout this entire process, that I have to say that Apple have really been very open and very supportive and very approachable, which was unthinkable for me before. Mm-hmm. I never knew that such a company would actually, invest a lot of effort and time into like exchanging emails back and forth, giving support, giving advice. We were like the indie of the indie, and we never thought that we could be the object of care from such a giant company. So I really think that the new face of Apple really resounds in this story. Mm-hmm. And I'd been a fanboy of Apple before, but after I was invited to WWDC, and I stood face to face with them. We worked together for some time. I saw everything from the inside. I had the inner perspective at all this, and I have to say that all the premises of my fanboyism were really true.
That's so great.
That was the real thing. And having come back from that amazing adventure, I really hold all the more respect for them and for the new philosophy of this openness and approachability that they seem to be betraying to me.
Terrific.
Well, one of the things I heard is that you gave a really, really well-received talk there, and you touched on areas that I think never get enough attention, and that's accessibility. And I think you did specifically accessibility and autism.
But I wouldn't call it accessibility. I would just call it inclusivity. Essentially,
I love that description.
Well, essentially what I wanted to say throughout the talk, it was a lunchtime session, was that if you design with this very, very delicate and very ticklish mind that has cognitive disabilities, such as people on the autistic spectrum. If you keep this in the back of your head all the time when you're making your app, this can take whatever it is that you're making to this super accessible and all-inclusive level for just everyone. So, you know, it's as if, you know, making an app that really runs smoothly through everyone's perception, as long as you take some very simple guidelines into account that make things easier for people with cognitive impairments. So it's, you know, basically about opening up your app and including everyone, ranging from the spectrum to your very general and broad audience. So I try to shift the outlook that everyone may have on UX and UI towards cognitive impairments, which would in turn make their app just super well received and accessible to just anyone. Because, like I always say, the user on the autistic spectrum, has this, you know, very sensitive, and very critical mind that can be put off by some simple bad design decisions. And, this really resounds in the perception of just your everyday user. They just don't really, they can't really put a finger to that. So yeah, so that's what my talk was about. Plus how I learned programming and, my perception of Objective-C and how much I love Longline.
Well, that sounds, yeah, so, that sounds great. And
yeah, it was very cool.
I love to hear success stories about you, from people like you and apps out there, because I still think there's a lot of opportunity out there for new things, for completely new wheels, and also for reinventing wheels. There's nothing wrong with that too. So, yeah,
I agree, and I love the notion of calling it or describing it as inclusiveness.
Yes. Which we'd use a lot more of all over.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I've been a fan of accessibility for years. I think the Mac does it amazingly well, and one of my first projects was playing with that API. And iOS is just great at it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, just by saying the word inclusiveness, I'm like, oh, right, now I get it. Like, I've always thought it was a good idea, but you know, you kind of flip the proposition when you just call it trying to be inclusive rather than being accessible. Like accessible yes. means like I'm going out of my way to like put a ramp in front of the door. Inclusiveness just means like I want to include everybody.
It's just good business when you think about it.
Well, it's just being a good person, really. It's just, it's good. It's just, I love the notion of it.
Yeah. Right. But yes, I mean, but I was trying to come at it from somewhere other than just altruism or,
sure.
yeah. you know, morality. I mean, it's like, why don't people do this and think about this kind of thing? Because, duh, customers.
Yeah. Well, even if you're a jerk, you should do accessibility.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, Vesper did it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
yeah. And I mean,
Guy, you're saying they're huge jerks, right?
Oh, complete.
oh, yeah. I hate those guys.
yeah. And I mean, accessibility is a term that is limiting by default, you know, because you're just going out of your way to cater for some very specific closed group of people. And that's really not the point. You know, the point is to just broaden your spectrum and just invite a broader range of audience in your app. And that doesn't only mean people with accessibility or cognitive problems. This also means kids or the elderly or people who are holding the iPad for the first time in their life. You know, one of my testers for my app was my graphic designer's grandmother, who has never ever used a smartphone or an iPad or seen one.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. So we did our user tests on her and it went really well. So so this is what I mean by inclusivity and inclusiveness. Just, you know, opening up to a broader audience, which is like a win-win for everyone.
It reminds me of an early experience I had with NetNewsWire back, must have been 2003, I think. A blind user, sent Sheila and I a recording of what it was like, of what that person heard when they were using our app.
And that's cool.
Yeah. And it was like, and frankly, it was, you know, more than 10 years ago. I hadn't even thought about accessibility or inclusivity or anything. But we got this recording and the app worked wonderfully. And it was a whole different way of thinking about our app. Now, we were lucky that AppKit, you know, had all this stuff baked in. I almost didn't have to do anything. In fact, I didn't do anything to make it work. But just hearing that and hearing that person be, you know, really excited about this app and like wanting us to hear how well it worked was really, really cool. I've never forgotten that.
That's great. That's, man, you got to feel so good at that point.
Yeah, well, you know, nearly in tears with, you know, just joy, just listening to that. Yeah, it's really cool.
You know, what's really, that's great to hear. And I think there's a lot of people in Apple that are very happy about that and proud about that. And, you know, some of these capabilities in OS X and iOS come from tragedy, actually. You know, we had an engineer who had two children born blind. And he was just moved to do something about that, you know, to make what he did for a living available to his children in the future and to other children he had met. And, you know, he was just on a mission from God to make things better. And out of tragedy like that, you get such wonderful things happening to the OS. And it was, you know, it was like the pebble starting rolling down the hill. Mm-hmm. It just got more powerful and more powerful. And, you know, everybody really took this seriously at Apple. I remember being an executive review with Scott Forstall, and Scott was adamant, like, so what are we doing for this next version of the OS to improve things? What, you know, who can we reach out to? Not just people with visual impairment, but hearing impairment, motion impairment. And I was just so proud of the place that I worked at because of that. And to hear that story, Brent, you know, that the work that those teams, you know, not that I did, but these other teams did, just help these people out and help make your app more powerful. That's why you do this kind of shit for a living. You know, that's just, you know, you want to change the world. Yeah, I'm preaching again. I got to stop that.
You're a good preacher.
Yeah, and by the way, guys, there's this wonderful, wonderful talk by Robin Christofferson. He's the chair of inclusive digital design, I think, at AbilityNet, the head of digital inclusion, sorry. He's blind, and he came over to my hometown of Krakow last year to do a talk at a conference for mobile developers called Mobile Conf. And he did a talk called Technology, the Power and the Promise. That talk is on Vimeo. If you search for Robin Christofferson Vimeo, I think that's the first result. So basically, he went up on stage and he presented the way he used his iPhone as a blind person. And it was so exhilarating and so stunning to witness because he used his iPhone faster than every one of us, than a sighted person, like, seriously. Plus, you know, he would do things like, you know, navigating maps, or he even edited a video to show on one of his slides and played it.
Wow.
So, if there's just like one talk on inclusivity and accessibility that you'll ever see, make sure it's this one. It's absolutely perspective changing.
I'd love to get you, him, and Charles Perry in a conference together sometime. I don't know if you've ever seen or heard Charles Perry speak on accessibility.
I never have, actually.
I'm not sure if his talk from UL last year is online anywhere, but a lot of what you're saying is just, you know, very similar to what I've heard Charles say too. So just
he does the Release Notes podcast as well.
Yeah, he does the Release Notes podcast as well. Really good guy. But yeah, the developers need to be thinking about this more. I know that, you know, it is a constant thing being, you know, lucky to have all your facilities and faculty being a detriment to doing good development sometimes, because you're not thinking enough about, you know, expanding your market, about what can I do to make this app more inclusive? And it's not just about people with disabilities. It's about people of different ages, of different locations.
Different cultures.
Different cultures. it's all part of the same kind of bag. And we just as developers, we just don't think about this stuff enough.
We'll do more, Don.
We'll do more. We'll do better.
Promise.
All right. We're actually almost exactly at 2 hours here.
Amazing how that always happens.
Oh, dear. Has it been 2 hours already?
Yes.
Wow.
I just looked up at the clock and I noticed that. That's when you're talking to fun people. It's that happens.
Yeah, man, we could go all day. Let's wrap it up a little bit. So, Brent, what are you most excited about from DubDub, or from what we've discussed today?
Well, let's see. Let's set Swift aside, because that excites me hugely.
Sure.
One thing I haven't mentioned that I'm really excited about is that user interface work on Macs has gotten rational and easier recently.
Yep.
From WWDC, you know, that we got, and its view controller is now, you know, in the responder chain, and it has things like view did load. We've got storyboards on AppKit now. And at the same time, it looks like Apple is continuing to move back in the direction of consistency in their user interfaces, which makes it easier to adopt to use, you know, standard controls rather than having to make everything custom.
Right.
And of course, as we all know, every time you do a custom thing, you've also got to do the accessibility thing. Whereas
right.
if you're using a standard thing, that stuff tends to be built in and working really, really well. Doing UIs easier, rational, cost less, which excites me a lot, because really that's my job right now. I mean, I've got Vesper for Mac is almost entirely a UI thing, right? Because all the other code's already written and shared. So
that's what I'm still looking forward to that.
You gotta
slip me a version of that at some point.
Okay.
Yeah. Don, what are you most excited about?
Well, I'll do the same thing. I'll set aside Swift, because that was the thing that really, like I said, got me to pay for actually being a developer. Just so I could play with it. The thing is, I like to think about it as in some ways as a customer and not a developer, because, you know, being retired now, to me, it's a delight you know, just getting the new packages from Apple and, you know, and I don't have to be in the sausage factory, you know, anymore, and know how painful it was to do that. I get the new stuff. It's like, oh, wow, this is really cool. And so it's not only just getting about new stuff from Apple, like continuity and handoff, but I'm looking forward to it. And I wasn't kidding about all this new stuff from Apple is going to make all these great new apps. I'm just looking to fall this year to have all sorts of new, really cool apps for me to play with, you know, readily. And that's the thing that I just love it when technology gets in the hands of smart, crazy people, because wonderful things happen. So
change the world.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Natalia? There's a certain experience that I have sometimes when I see an app and I think, why the hell didn't I think of that? It seems so obvious in retrospect. And I could have made all this money. Yeah, yeah. Great hero.
Yeah.
We're going to see some of those things.
Yeah. And you get jealous, but you're like, yeah.
But I love it. Yeah.
Like you meet the people and they're awesome. And you're like, jealous of you. I hate you. But.
Yeah. It's even worse when you find out they're really nice people.
Yeah. It's like, you're the worst. Sorry. Natalia, what are you looking forward to?
Yeah, like I mentioned at the very beginning, the favorite thing that I saw at WWDC was Swift paired up with Playgrounds. So the way that this is welcoming to the next generation of programmers and to kids and girls who always wanted to learn how to program, but the entry bar was just set way too high. You know, this completely changes how programming is taught and understood, I think. And I love the fact that Chris Lattner paid a little homage to Brett Victor's ideas here.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is finally learnable programming and understandable programming and instant gratification all in one. So I'm really super excited to see where education and computer science teaching takes Swift and Playgrounds in particular.
So one of the topics that came up a lot during the earlier run of the show was that, you know, I learned programming, I think, same as Don and probably Brent, like on an old Apple II where you use BASIC and go to. Mm-hmm. And the question was always like, well, okay, so what do you do now? Like, how do kids learn now? And I think for a long time that, and maybe it still is, you know, you learn web programming effectively. But I do think that this Playground stuff, and, you know, Brett Victor's ideas percolating down into actual products, you know, maybe that's how kids are going to start learning in the future.
Web programming.
Sure. No, I do too. Yeah. Because it's real programming. You're actually really programming this stuff. But you can see it happen in real time, which is kind of close to what the experience we had with BASIC. Not really, but you know what I mean? Like it's a very,
very
fast
much so.
Loop that you get into, right?
Yeah.
And I wrote my first BASIC program when I was 5, and then I just left the idea of programming for the next 20-odd years, right?
This makes sense. So you are one of us.
Yeah, and I mean, BASIC still gives me this warm and furry buzz when I think of it. I just love the memory of BASIC, but it's just that computers back then were so limited that was pretty much the only thing other than playing games on your Commodore or whatnot that you could do, learning BASIC, because that was the manual that came with the computer, you know, the manual for BASIC. And I mean, that's all you did because you had no other way to go. And now I think it's all so scattered that it's really hard to go in one singular path of learning how to program.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. But I do think that the getting back to your point about inclusiveness, I think Playgrounds kind of address that, not necessarily in the way that we were talking about previously, but they're far more approachable to somebody who doesn't know how to program than, you know, file new and you got like a .m file and then you got to compile. What
what does compiling mean? Then you got a link. What is, you know, and then something doesn't happen because you forgot to add a framework in the third tab over from the top, and then just
exactly it strips away all of these layers of unnecessary difficulty, and you can just dive right in, and that's beautiful.
Yes.
And that's how I've been using the language since WWDC. I'm not actually going out there and creating a lot of projects. I find hours of amusement in the playgrounds, appropriately named. But I think it's not only going to be good for kids and the generation of people or a set of people who've never thought about programming. I think it's also really good for people who are on the edge or the intersection points with programmers, like designers.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is – and the other tool that you were talking about with
SpriteKit.
I think those types of tools, those are the future. And the other Star Trek future we need to move into, it takes us towards, really. And this is where I try to like asphyxiate the Luddite in me, is we get to the future where we don't care about things like syntax or what the operators are, where we're not writing programs in text anymore.
Right? Yeah.
We need to get to that Star Trek future eventually. And this is a way where we can also explore that.
Yeah. And I love the way that I can now start to incorporate my designer into my workflow because of the tools that Apple
exactly,
gives us.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. This is all good. Which goes back to my point of like, what is Android doing to keep up with where the puck just got slammed across the ice to? You know what? I don't see what that is.
I don't know if it matters, but it won't. So here's the thing. I don't think it'll matter for a year or two, right? Until everything starts taking advantage of all those goodies. And to be fair to Android, they have had extensions-ish stuff for a while.
They've got Art now, and they've got the extensions for GPUs, and they've got Go as a language somewhere in the background.
Does Go run on Android?
Not yet. They just have so many things. I mean, I think Gruber did an article recently that says that they basically compete with everybody in tech at this point.
Yeah.
And themselves.
Yeah.
That's the other important thing.
Well, you've got to take themselves. Google out if you're Google, right?
Yeah.
The only way to survive is a company.
Yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But I think it's a hard act to follow. With the strength of the field from Apple and just the focus, you know, there's not a lot of duplication there of effort.
No, it remarkably so, given that they're usually pretty closed. Yeah. The fact that they
what I'm sure is this will tank the stock price.
That always happens. I think it's up today, actually.
It is.
I think Don means the podcast will tank the stock price.
Oh, yeah. This podcast. Yeah. Yeah, we really moved the needle on the Apple stock here.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, I will gladly podcast with you all again. This has been fascinating conversation. It's a delight to talk to Brent again and Natalia to meet you and hear your wonderfully fresh perspective. And
yeah,
of course, those old guys. So
yeah, thanks a lot.
It's been wonderful. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Natalia, great meeting you.
So let me just go quickly around the table. Brent, where can people find you and where can they read your blog and get your program?
You can go to my blog at inessential.com and you can, it links to my Twitter and all those things from there.
And your app is Vesper in the App Store.
Vesper, yep.
Don, what about you?
DonMilton.com, where I haven't been writing lately, but links to a lot of my stuff. And of course, at Don Milton on Twitter.
And if you want to see the app you used to work on, it's built into your OS X and your iOS.
Yes, yes, exactly.
What about you, Natalia?
Natalia Berdis at Batalia on Twitter with a B in the beginning. The website of my company is tutulab.com. That's tutulab.com, where you can see some of the cool photos of me and my co-designer, Joanna, and more info about our lovely app for kids that we have out on the App Store.
That's Fudo Kitchen?
That's Fudo Kitchen, yep.
Awesome.
I can't believe I wasn't following Natalia. Fixed.
Thank you everyone so much, guys. This was awesome.
Thank you. It's been delightful. My first podcast ever, and I'm loving it.
Awesome. Well, we're going to get you back. We're going to have you back. You're a star.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, guys. It's such a pleasure meeting you. Looking forward to talking to you, too.
Guy, can you stay on for just a second? I have a couple things I have to ask you.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to go rescue my wife from my dog.
All right. Have a good one. Talk to you guys soon.
Yeah. All right.
Bye. Thanks, Brent. Thanks, Talia. Thanks, Don.
See you,
Brent.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.